Welcome back to the Mojo podcast. A short interlude since I last spoke to Ben Branson from C-Lip. And the reason for that is I was just really keen to get some time with my guest today. And sometimes, as in life, you just have to wait for the right time to talk. And time came and we had a magnificent conversation about the mindset of a performer. In this case, an incredibly talented musician. Sean Williams is a singer-songwriter, teacher from Cambridge in the UK. He's been involved in music and entertainment for over 20 years, since his early teenage years. Not only honing his craft here, but also having spent extensive time working in the US while signed to Columbia Records and working with the legendary soul artist Betty Wright in her Miami Spice publishing company. Sean's Mojo journey has seen him travel the world, yet always stay local through teaching and mentoring young performers. And whether it be teaching a choir locally or being on the road touring with Craig David, the message stays the same and the intention true. In Sean's words, you're only ready to receive what you're truly willing to give. Now, I've known Sean for quite a few years. I've always enjoyed his company and his philosophical view on life. Sean and my wife are godparents to our beautiful nephew, Forrest. Indeed, Sean mentions his best friend and Forrest's dad, Fraser, my brother-in-law, during the episode. So this is a bit of an extended family affair, you may say, and I absolutely loved it. Yes, we talk about Sean's long career in music, what he's learned, who's taught him, and how he's passed that knowledge on. And I'm not simply talking about how to hit high notes here, but more how to be yourself and stay true to yourself in an industry where performance is everything and people are judging you on your output all the time. So we get into the performer mindset, and Sean speaks very honestly about what it means to him and how he deals with the pressure of singing in front of tens of thousands of people. You're going to enjoy hearing Sean's experience. You're going to find his wisdom fascinating, and you're going to love his pure passion for what he does. We had a lot of fun. I hope you love it too. And as we're approaching the festive period, a little gift to you from the Mojo podcast. I've been quietly compiling a Spotify playlist of the songs that my guests say really gets their mojo going. There are over 20 tunes, amazing tunes to listen to. And they're on, there's a Spotify playlist, and you can find the link in the show notes. And of course, Sean's amazing choice is in there. You'll love it. Also see the show notes for how to find out more about Sean and what he's doing. He's a great follow on Instagram. And please do share this episode, give it a 5-star rating, and please do leave that short review on Apple Podcasts, all of which really helps more people discover the Mojo podcast. So over to my Mojo conversation with Sean Williams. So welcome back to the Mojo podcast. It is wonderful to be back. As I said, a short break in between guests, but I've been really focused on getting my next guest onto the show. I'm extremely excited to be joined today by Sean Williams, all the way from sunny Cambridge. Are you in Cambridge, Sean, in the UK?
Yeah, but not so sunny, but it's, you know, in my heart it is, Rich.
In your heart. Oh, that's beautiful, Sean. Always sunny in your heart. I know you as an extremely positive, optimistic, uplifting person. And today we're talking about music. And what is not uplifting about music? It is positive. It is optimistic. So just the perfect person to talk to about music. So Sean, before I go any further, I need to check in with you. So how is your mojo today in not so sunny Cambridge?
Do you know what? I'm feeling at quite a nice high 8.5, kind of 9. It's definitely on like an upward trajectory. It feels good. It feels very good.
Moving upwards. Nice. And what's lying behind that? What's going on?
I've had some personal evolution. And for most of us, I think we look at moments where we organically grow within hindsight, and I am trying to develop what I call insight, which is my ability to be able to process information that will help me to learn quicker within the moment, instead of having to go through, then you isolate, look back, and then figure out what you did or didn't do. And I've felt that some of the choices I've made based on the why have allowed me to find a greater perspective and what I call a center balance, which means that I'm not really trying to lean to over optimism, and at the same time I'm not leaning overly towards pessimism. I think within myself I'm generally a person that is quite hopeful, so I'm always looking for that thing behind it which will give purpose. Yet at the same time, I'm kind of also okay knowing that you need the sunshine and the rain. So do I need my flip-flops or my umbrella? Either way, I'm going to keep walking.
Love that. I love that. So hindsight to insight.
For sure.
That balance that you talk about, whether that's sunshine, rain, it's, I guess they both happen. Is it how you choose to deal with that?
For sure. But also, Rich, you need sunshine and rain to grow. And I think sometimes that's what I talk about in terms of balance, is that you can't hope to live in 365 days of sunshine, because when you need your crop to come out, it's just going to be dry ground, arid ground. Same way, I don't want 365 days of rain, because you're going to flood everything. So then there must be almost a harmony and a balance, knowing that the transitional changes is what creates what we need to holistically move forward. Because some of us you'll find great success in what you're doing, but then in an emotional sense or a personal sense, you'll feel like you're falling, because what I call that holistic balance isn't met, because a lot of the time we focus on the thing that is giving us the most visual result. And that's not often the permanent thing that's going to kind of allow us to get to where we want to get to, if that makes sense. I know I've gone around the bushes a little bit.
No, man, it's a lovely opening. And I think we're starting to get a sense of your personal philosophy straight out of the gate, in terms of perhaps, you know, my next question about what mojo means to you. And you're, there's some delicious things that have come up there, and I'm particularly attracted to when you talk about harmony and balance. Is that where you're finding mojo?
Do you know what, Rich? I took a moment this morning, because I was going through just some correspondence you and I had. And I sat there and I said to myself, what is mojo? And I came up with this, almost this four-word definition. I believe, well, to me, it's obviously it's opinion. To me, mojo is divinely imputed intrinsic source.
Wow. Okay. Divinely
imputed intrinsic source.
Intrinsic source.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, because obviously the kids, and I teach young people. So for the longest time, all everything was, swag, 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 swag. And then swag evolved into source. And basically, it was just their way of saying, like, your personal cool.
Ah, right. It's swag, because I'm an older man.
Dude, don't worry. I'm right down that bridge with you.
Is that seriously wild, audacious goals? Is that a different swag?
Wow. Seriously wild, audacious. That, I think, is, you've just educated me. So now I know what it actually stands
That's
for.
That's a rarity.
Richie, I love it. So, yeah. Seriously, what did you call it?
Seriously wild, audacious goals is one thing I've seen that could be
that.
Swag.
I love that. And what I feel that swag and source is, it is your personal confidence that comes out when you're doing the thing that you're supposed to do. It's your passion, it's your desire, it's your purpose. And I believe that our passions and our desires and our purposes are the hidden treasures that are put in each and every one of us that we must find. And the reason why a lot of us go through life and we don't find it is because we become convinced by what we think we need to do or have to do, rather than following that which we need to do, that thing which gives you the most passion, that gives you the most joy, that brings out your inner joy when you do it. And so that's why, to me, I believe that real mojo, it's that divinely imputed intrinsic source, because what that then enables you to do is, it doesn't require anybody else to validate it. It's completely self-generated. And in a time when we're all talking about, you know, I love it because people are becoming more what I call soul conscious. So everybody talks about energy. The only problem I have with energy is that energy is neither lost nor found. It's merely transferred. So based on what you're generating or what you've picked up, you can affect me. When we talk about divine intrinsic source, oh, you're going to have to find a way to basically protect yourself from what I believe is my radioactive passion that will come, and you won't be able to deny it. So what you have can't necessarily externally affect me, because I am internally generating what we call mojo.
Right. So the fact that it comes from you yourself, it cannot be passed on to you. It was in you for always.
And this
is the journey, right? This is what we're on, whether hunt for mojo, hunt for meaning. It's finding what, as you said, what you're supposed to do.
Yeah. Almost like an artesian well. It springs up from within and just bursts out. Does that make sense? Like, you've been, Rich, you've been walking down the road and someone has taken your eye. They've not said anything. They've not even done anything, but you feel what's coming out of them. And the easiest way that we describe is, oh, their energy, their aura. Yes, in a sense. But then we also would then sometimes, the restrictions we put on that is that we say, oh, you've got to protect your energy and protect your... If I'm self-generating something, I don't need to protect anything. It's you're the one that's going to need protecting, because if you decided to stay in that anti system, I promise you get around me for 5 minutes, that anti is going to turn into a pro real quick.
I love this sense of it's in us. It comes back to a lot about self-reliance and almost a responsibility, right? Because when it's in you, you have to go and find it. You can't expect it to be gifted, handed, transferred, as you say, to you. Yeah.
It's almost like the responsibility then becomes on you.
Yeah.
What are you doing with it? How are you mining it? What are you doing to protect it? How are you harvesting it?
Beautiful. I love that. So I knew this would be an explosion of wonderful thoughts and feeling and very profound from the off. Now, Sean, we're going to talk, you know, we're going to use music as somewhat of a guiding light, a North Star here, because, you know, you are a professional musician, you're a teacher, you're a coach, you do much, and we're going to come on to that. I want to go slightly back, and this, I guess this comes back to exactly what you said about finding what you're supposed to do. Now, when did you find what you were supposed to do?
Very early on. My father is a church minister, and I grew up in a Pentecostal church. I grew up in a Pentecostal home, or a Christian home, I should say. And as a lot of people know, especially within the Pentecostal church, that in terms of music, very vibrant, from the percussive nature of most of our hymns that start slow, by the end of it, Rich, it's going. Like, it's really going.
Right.
Yeah. So, and everybody will get hold of a tambourine or some form of instrument that will add to the corporate nature of worship. So from a very young age, I was around music, I was immersed in music. So I understood the power of music as an expressive art form. What church allowed me to do was to understand the divine nature of the message that we were singing about, and how that would not only, if music on its own makes people feel good, it was the message that then became transformative and affected them on the longer term in terms of what they wanted to do and the principles they wanted to live their life. But for me, it was the music was just, yeah, from the moment you walked in till the moment we walked out, going.
What's one of your, because I love talking to people about really early memories in life. Do you have what you think is your very first memory of being in and around music?
Oh yeah, 1,000,000%. Especially the young boys, we all wanted to play the drums. Because the drummer was just always the coolest guy in the church.
Yes. Yeah.
And our drummer was a guy called Clive Brown. That's a lie. Clive Simpson. And Clive was a cool guy. Didn't say much. But when he got on them drums, he was just the coolest guy in the building, Rick. And I remember we all used to sit there and like we'd ask him if he wanted us to hand him a stick, do you want Brush's cry, or do you want the bamboo stick? And he was just really cool. And at the end, you always used to let everybody have turns, have a little play. And so you had this moment of watching the musicians in harmony, and then you'd see the choir that were feeding off the musicians, and then the choir was leading the congregation. And it was these different stations that was creating this collective experience. And dude, my head was just gone.
And what sort of age was that, Sean?
About 6 or 7.
Yeah. So a really, just in really important time, you're just sucking so much in, I imagine, at that age, the way your brain's developing. And this feeling, this almost what you're describing to me, this sort of transformational power of the congregation coming together, the musicians playing, the sheer joy of it, from what I'm hearing, was obviously very impactful.
I think it's what we get when, like some of my friends, they will go to watch a football match. Some of my friends, they love the rugby. Now, when you hear, let's say the England fans, when they were singing Swing Low. Now, obviously, there's things going on in the world where they don't want to sing it so much. But in terms of, I believe, the intention of them all singing it together, it used to bring about unity. That was a big thing. Obviously, you've got everything that is to do with the song, 100%. But I'm talking about how music can bring people that will have completely different views about stuff together in a moment of unified chorus to create an atmosphere that can change something they cannot physically touch with. Are you being serious? That's power, man. In football games, Rich, I watch, and I hate Liverpool because I'm a Man United fan, but my God, Rich, when You Never Walk Alone gets going at the beginning and they turn the record off and the cop and the rest of Anfield get together in the chorus of that song. Rich, as a Man United fan, I sit there and I'm like, oh, I hate you, man. But, oh, this is beautiful.
We'll get goosebumps at that collective unity. The power of that is amazing.
Yeah.
I've had one of my guests this series, a guy called Johnny Lee, who's an acid house missionary. So back in the 80s, he was playing a lot of the illegal acid house raves and stuff. And his reflection on this is that, you know, back to football, but remember, football in the 80s was a very dangerous, ugly place.
Oh, yeah.
It was the football hooliganism, rampant racism, just pretty awful, frankly. But he said those guys who would be literally trying to kill each other Saturday daytime, Saturday evening, when they all got together in a rave tent, would be hugging. Because they came together, exactly as you say, in that collective unity. So, yeah. Power of music, whatever, however you take it in, it's incredibly, incredibly powerful. Incredibly powerful. You got into music professionally pretty young. So after the church, what was then going on for you in terms of a career in music? How did that start?
So at 10 years old, my primary school teacher, amazing woman called Debbie Rains, now Debbie Harris, she had some wonderful links with the BBC and most notably a very successful producer over there called Robert House. Robert House was running a TV show that basically was a nationwide talent search for young singer-songwriters. And she put me forward and I ended up getting through. So my immersion into music was actually via TV first. I stayed in touch with Bob House after the process and stuff, which was amazing. And that then led me into doing a stint in the West End in Bugsy Malone.
Wow.
And obviously, And obviously, I think this was like, I must have been 12 at this time. And I remember missing the whole of the first year of secondary school because I had to move to London. I was living with my gran.
So you're now a professional musician, essentially, from the age
of 12.
Wow.
And from that moment, that was wonderful. And then after I did that, my parents realized that I needed to actually kind of spend some time in school. So they wouldn't let me do anything for about 3 years, 4 years.
Yeah.
And then as I finished my GCSEs, there were some producers in London that had heard about me. I'd started working with a local producer in Cambridge called Lawrence Michelli, who was going under the name DJ Crafty. And then we started taking the B-side of records, and I'd write original music, and he would stick it at the front of his mixtapes. And dude, like in all crazy stories, this mixtape ended up on the desk of a guy called Steve Greenberg. Steve Greenberg had just moved to Columbia Records, which is a subsidiary of Sony. And he had found Hanson, just signed Joss Stone. He was responsible for Baha Men, Who Let the Dogs Out. So, yeah, real talk. Fountains of Wayne. Do you remember Stacey's mum's got it going on?
I do, yeah.
That's Greenberg. So Greenberg's just like, I'm doing my A-levels. So I find out that they want to sign me first year of my A-levels. My head's gone because I'm just like, I'm going to be ripped. So what have I got to stay in school for?
Yeah.
And then, honestly, and then I think me and Fraser, but Fraser's really cool because he's super smart. So Fraser can miss like three quarters of the year and then study for a week and be perfect. That wasn't my path. So I got in a lot of trouble that year when my parents saw the results. And then I moved to America and went straight into a deal.
Wow. I mean, because that's, as you say, what a pivotal time. You're 16, 17, doing A-levels, all yeah. Well, frankly, pressure and expectation that comes from that with, and most teenagers go through that without the head turning attraction of, you know, do you want to come and like be part of this crazy music industry, which looks pretty sexy, right?
It wasn't bad, Rich. It wasn't bad. But it was necessary when I look back now, because I realized how much I needed to shed in order to get into the position I am now and be as focused by it and about it as I am, if that makes sense, you know? And I learned a lot of things in the folly of my youth that has enabled me to be a teacher that can really interact with my students now, because I don't speak to them from a basis of you have to listen to what I say. The first lesson I teach all of my students is I need you to hold everything I say in suspicion until you've proven this for yourself.
Ooh,
tell me 100%.
Right, okay. Let's think as a teacher, a lot of teachers, their power is essentially coming from knowledge and credibility based on them being the qualified person in the room. You're saying don't listen to anything I'm saying really until you can prove it to yourself. Is that fair?
100%.
Okay.
And that is why so many teachers lose three quarters of the students in their classroom, because they are trying to tell them that they should listen to them based on the fact they are them. Nobody, and I don't mean it in a horrible way, they don't care. They're the information generation. They can get what they want in a minute. Rich, they are the only generation to believe that they can wake up today and tomorrow be a billionaire.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Is that, I guess if you think about your teacher as a font of knowledge, it would have been to us. Now the font of knowledge is actually my phone. So, you know, you're going to have to do something else, Mrs. and Mr. Teacher, to bring me 100%. Along the way, right?
And the something else is practical experience, Rich.
Good old University of Life, Sean.
Dude, because you can get me on information, I can get you on life.
You talk about you went to the States, again, a pretty young age. What were you seeing and what were you learning that enabled you to thrive in that? Again, you're a long way from home, right?
A long way from home, dude. I was very blessed that my parents were very diligent in terms of the people that were around me. So my older brother, Leon, he moved out to America with me. There was a guy that had been looking after my career for about 3 years at that point called Omar Holmes, amazing guy. He flew out with me. And my friend who I was doing the music with that got me signed, he came out to New York with me as well. So I went out there with like a family of brothers.
Right. Good support network around you.
Oh, for sure. And the label were really good in the fact that anytime I felt like I needed to go home, they'd send me home for the weekend. So they'd let me fly out like Thursday evening and then I could fly back in like Sunday night. So that enabled me to sometimes break it up and not feel like, oh my gosh, I'm just in this place. And obviously to an 18-year-old living in, Times Square before I decided to move to Miami, it was amazing. but it was just like, I'm not the biggest fan of London. So it just felt like London on steroids to me. I was just like, this is the worst. Somebody get me out of here now.
Yeah. And what was that? Did you find some ally? We obviously had a good crew around you. Was it that crew that said, look, sure, there is another way here. You don't have to stay where you think you might have to stay. There is something else we can do.
Yeah. We'd move out to the different sessions I'd have to do. So I might fly to LA one week and then come back home. So our base was in New York. And then I had this amazing experience where Steve Greenberg wanted to send me to this soul legend called Betty Wright. Now, Betty Wright was very instrumental in Joss Stone's first project that really broke her into the mainstream. And I don't know what it was. We were only meant to go down there for 4 days, and 4 days turned into 3.5 years. In that first week, I just felt something that was the closest thing to parental love when I went to Miami. And the funniest thing, Rich, is I actually lost Betty Wright this year. She passed away, a couple of months ago. And I was talking to her daughters and I was saying to the girls, I was just like, can you imagine that things that Mama B told me in 2010 is happening now and last year? She was the first person, Rich, to talk to me, and this is almost a decade before, about the very nature of the job I'm doing right now. So sometimes when I sit and I talk about being a student or a teacher, it's because I know what it is and what you need to do on the other side to cross the bridge. And she allowed her experiences to become my stepping stone. And it gave me tremendous depth and peace more than anything. Because the one thing she taught me, she was just like, and she was like, baby, you have to understand. And she basically tried to tell me that you have to find what you need in amongst the pile of people giving you what you want. That, in essence, is the denial of self, Rich. You have to deny yourself. And it's mental to have someone telling you to deny yourself when every day you're getting a free pass to Willy Wonka's chocolate factory.
Well, and especially in the music industry, right, Sean? Because we're talking, this is not a normal 9-to-5 gig. This, as you said, comes with a lot of bells and whistles and a lot of distractions. So her message to you is essentially, ignore all of that, Sean. It's going to be distracting, but keep on this path and you'll get to where you meant to, as you said, what you're supposed to do, coming back to your definition of mojo.
For sure. It was definitely because she'd won Grammys. She knew what it was to sell millions of records. She had done so many amazing things in her life. And it's like she had traversed the whole world, the one that was musical and the natural one. And it's like she had realized that it was the moments where she was serving that she was being made to lead. And when she did become that leader, she never lost the art of service. True service, Rich. Not that fake stuff, the real stuff. And every time I go on the stage, that's my first thought. I'm like, how do I serve? How do I serve? In this moment, how do I give more than I'm getting back?
Right. So because I wanted to come on to specifically exactly what you're talking about, the performer mindset, and specifically yours, because we are all unique and you've got your view of it. And I want to get into that. So this sense of true service, can you try and give the listeners a sense of what does that feel like when you're stepping up onto a stage now? And there's a particular stage, because I would like you just to reflect on something, because I know you're a very humble guy. But I'm going to just throw that out, because I saw Sean on stage, not just any stage, but the Pyramid stage at Glastonbury 2017, I think it was.
Yeah.
You were working, as you still are, with Craig David and the band. Now, can I just take you back to that moment? Because I was in the crowd with my wife and our mutual friend, Jim, watching you, full of pride for you. What was it? What did it feel like for you when you stepped out onto that stage? What was your performer mindset then?
You know what, Rich? I had a few moments backstage before we went on where that's where I condensed the emotions, because what I knew I couldn't do was, when I stepped out on that stage, I had a job to do. And so I was very aware that I couldn't allow my emotional output to override or influence what I needed to do in that moment. Because in that moment, I am a part of a greater dynamic. So, Rich, the first thing when I got up those stairs, I was like, oh, my Lord. Oh, my Lord. I was like, bro, like, I was watching this last year. I said, this is what's going on behind it. Honestly, really. I was like, of course, this is what's happening. And then at that time, the Labour Party were flying and there was a certain MP that had given a ridiculous speech and everybody was, you could feel the energy of everybody.
It was Jeremy Corbyn, my friend.
Right, the Corbynator was
just
there.
Just been on before
and
you.
Honestly, the Corbynator had been on, absolutely smashed it. And I couldn't believe how many people he'd got to come and listen to him speak.
Yeah, yes, my friend. So it was a popular spot, that one.
It really was. So my thing was just like, oh my gosh, everybody's ready for a party. Like, I can't mess up. Like, if we mess up, like, this is not going to be good. But at that stage, the show was so tight, Rich, because right. We had gone through the moments that you need to, where you get rid of what I call the miscellaneous that can happen. Mm. There are some things that will go on a stage that you just can't account for. So you have to be able to keep going irrespective. But then there are other things that can go wrong because you are not where you're supposed to be, either naturally, mentally, or within your performance giving.
Got it.
And what I was able to do was I work off this, every time my students come in at the moment, I say to them, repeat after me, repetition creates habit, habit shapes mentality, mentality determines character. We had got to a place where the repetition had created a good habit. We'd done the tour, so we're there. We know exactly what everything is. I feel like now, subliminally within myself, if certain of my bandmates give me a look, if the MD does something, I know what that means. I know where the options I might need to work. So what Glastonbury felt like was the perfect alignment of a process that was evolving into its next stage. And when I looked out, Rich, and you could only see people, I then realized that we were part of what I call an intrinsic irrigation system that required me to be sincere in the moment. So that that which would flow through the artist and out through the dynamics he's put around him. Do you understand what I'm saying? Don't make me a cup of coffee then decide when I've handed it to you to give to the other person, you're going to start adding sugar and cinnamon. No. Don't do that. I've made it. Just give it to them. So you just get used to allowing the flow to flow. You don't do nothing else other than just going, you're flowing through. You become an instrument that allows people to receive what they come for without you feeling the need to get in the way.
So this is back to that sense of service that you talk about. Yes. You are in service of, it sounds to me like obviously the crowd that have chosen to be there. It also sounds like you're in service of your bandmates who are around you. And in that, it sounds like an awful lot of trust to me.
Oh,
that gets built up. Is that fair?
I would say so. Because you are taking the most intimate thoughts and moments of a person's creative expression and relaying them to the world. Rich, can you imagine walking outside your house, finding a stranger on the road and telling them your most intimate secret?
Yes, maybe a bit tricky.
That's what I'm trying to say, but yet that's what we do. And more than that, you have to be okay with that because the person has the ability within themselves to know if you're being authentic.
Right. So this is back to, again, what it means to be a performer. It means to be a writer, which you are obviously as well, is to putting all these intimate thoughts on paper, but then out, because that's the point. You've got to share it. How does that feel? How does it feel being so transparent, so open, as you say, with complete strangers? We're not talking about your best friends and family here. You're putting what really matters to you most, and I know you feel a lot, and putting it out. How does that feel?
Okay, it's amazing because I just felt myself intrinsically intercept myself, because I was about to give you the answer, that what I call the PR answer, and then it was almost like myself said, no, that's not authentic, that's you just saying what you think you need to say. Rich, sometimes it's amazing, other times it's horrible. That's the truth.
Okay.
And the reason I say it's horrible is because sometimes you are exposing the fragility and nakedness of what's not there sometimes. But in that same moment, you are building the armor and the covering that will come to actually dress you in the next moment. So it's like you sacrifice now to gain in a moment, which sometimes goes against what we feel, because it's like, well, I'm in this position, so I shouldn't be feeling like this. But in order to truly give, it can't be what you think is what a person wants. It has to cost you something.
Right.
Do you understand?
I think so. I mean, and what's coming through for me is this sense of vulnerability, that you can't be in this service. You can't truly do it the way that you want to do it unless you're prepared to go to that level of vulnerability, which you're talking to.
And to sacrifice, because so many people look at it they look at it sometimes from an objective space, and they only see the visual aesthetic that goes around with the job. So no disrespect. Say now when you, Noosh, and I think Jimmy Kington was there as well.
Yep,
now, you're hanging out and you're at Glaston, and then all of a sudden you're like, wait there, I know that guy. And so everything that you associate with what you know and what you see will be like, oh my gosh, like he's having a great time, and I wonder what the village is like. And I remember, because I was trying to see if I could get you guys back there, because I was just like, guys, you'd love it. And then so you've got all these moments, and how you retell the story wouldn't necessarily be how I retell the story, because my day started at like 3 o'clock in the morning. And I'm up and I'm thinking about, okay, cool, this is Glastonbury. Do I have everything that I need to pack? Okay, cool. Is there anything that I've been over from the last changes that we did in rehearsal, so I make sure that this goes right? Because this is going to go on live TV. And if I mess this up, I could potentially turn my boss into a meme in seconds. Okay, cool. Can't do that. Let's make sure everything's cool. Then we get on the bus. Then you're on the bus and Kwame's saying, okay, cool, guys, this is what we're going to do. This is when our rehearsal time is going to be. Don't do this, do this. And we're finding out the dimensions of the stage without seeing the stage. Don't go here, you can't. And way before the time starts, Rich, before people think that I'm getting, I don't know, massages in the backstage village, and I'm meeting this person and hanging out with that person, there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on that a lot of the time people don't see, which is what I call the reality to the fantasy.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I think we all in our minds have a fantasy vision of what goes on in the music business, backstage, whatever, all the preparation. And what I'm hearing from you, and in that honesty, is a huge amount of pressure, potentially. And I want to ask you how you deal with that pressure, because as you say, you're effectively being employed by someone, Craig David and band. And you say, if you make an error, and it could be really small, it could be very big, fall off the stage, put a foot wrong, fall off the stage, that sort of thing, you could become a YouTube meme in seconds.
In moments.
Because for some reason, something has distracted you. So how are you managing that performance pressure?
You know what, it was funny, because this question ties into something I was thinking about from our prior correspondence, when you asked me a question, like, Sean, how do you maintain your mojo? And the key in me maintaining my mojo is the same key to how I deal with the pressure. Rich, three things.
Great.
I pray, I meditate, I serve.
Lovely.
I pray, prayer becomes my communication. So once I've expressed it, like we would with a therapist, you let it go. The great thing about my meditation is that the silence is where I have the realest conversation with that which is within. And I then step outside of time in meditation, because it's an infilling. And then I serve based on the conversation I've had. And if I'm having the correct conversation, my service is authenticated and validated in that moment. So it no longer, so basically what happens is that the prayer illuminates the pressure, the meditation disarms it, and the service makes it evaporate.
Wow. So this secular three-step system, as you say, you know, you can deal with whatever comes your way. I mean, so that's I asked you the question in the context of getting up on a big stage, but can you apply that to anything in life?
Yeah, 100%. Because that's exactly every process that has been transformative in my life has come from the basis of these three, what I call principles. The basis of all success is good communication, Rich, even in a negative sense. If you are working with a person you don't like, your communication with them will allow you to understand, or for them to express what they want and allow you to understand what they need. The basis of the meditation, it brings you down, because a lot of the time we're so used to being heard and wanting to be heard that a lot of the time we miss what it is to really listen. And sometimes it's your ability to stop pushing your own agenda to understand what you need to understand and see that then allows you to practically apply your action in the area where it's going to be most effective. So if I know that I'm feeling pressure about a big gig that's coming up, then what I'm able to do, and also my MD Kwame, he's been amazing with this. His big thing is always, guys, simplify the process. So he'll be like, if there's a song that you're having problems with, split the song over 3 or 4 days, start with the intro. Why do that, Kwame? Because the intro is only 8 bars long. So all of a sudden, 102 bar problem is now cut into a much more bite-sizable portion. And this is what I was finding my three-step method was doing. It was slicing the problem into bite-sized moments that I'd be like, oh, I can deal with that. Nice. Oh, I don't need that. Nice.
Yes. I mean, that's just really smart, because I mean, that whole, and I love hearing it, your approach, because it's yours, your application to what you do, but that sort of problem slicing of just, you know, I think it's an Oprah quote. It's about just do the next most important thing, right? Because it comes, this is where overwhelm comes from. When we look at everything that we have to do, it might be learn a complicated song. It might be, God, this presentation I have to give at work, whatever. But if you just focus on that next most important thing, you're going to be in a pretty good place. So that's kind of what I hear from that. So
yeah,
thank you.
100%. Oh, Rich, this conversation is doing me something wonderful.
Wow.
So thank you.
Man, it's enriching. And I just want to ask you, I've got a few more questions for you. Now, I did want to touch on, so clearly you're a man of faith. You grew up around the church and you work in the music industry. Has that ever been a real challenge for you? Have you been put in a position where you're, faith, your values get challenged by maybe some of the people you work with?
No. And the reason why I say that is because, Rich, I'm very confident, comfortable, and certain in who I am and what I think. And I say that in a way where when you have that comfortability with yourself, it doesn't require you to be loud or to forcefully push your ideas on anybody, and also it allows others to see you in a way where they can understand the parameters of who you are. And if you are authentically what you say and prove that in your action, that then becomes a bridge of respect and love, because I don't have to agree with you to respect you, because what that will do is that it will allow me to sit there and go, okay, cool, that's where you are, this is where I am, and I can appreciate that there is a little kind of mound in the middle where we leave that alone. And the other thing being is that I am not in a situation where I'm required to do anything that is against anything that I holistically think or believe. Does that make sense?
Yeah, completely. So, completely.
And I also believe that sometimes it is your ability to remain consistent in around inconsistency that provides the greatest example. And one of the things that's really allowed me to even, I'd say, kick on is the fact of the example I have in front of me at the front of the stage it's so consistent, Rich, that it allows me to go back to my room or to my bunk on the bus sometimes and challenge my version of me in an environment that is far less demanding. So it's like you have a measurement to mark your own progress. And then imagine that that measurement then comes to you and says to you, okay, cool. I'm now going to show you how to expand, and this is how you deal with this, and that's how you deal with that. So then even the flow of strength and you getting better comes from a place of, like, I know I keep saying this word, but it's sincere. When a person means it, and I think it's also a massive thing, but we're talking about performance, is that the reason why it's so important through the idea of service is that when you mean it, you have the ability to create a moment within a couple of seconds that will last for a lifetime. And when you watch the different streams and how they weave and then come together to create this unified, life-giving force, you're just like, so this is what it's about then. Do you understand what I'm saying, Rich? Because sometimes so many people just see what they want to take out of a situation and they don't realize how much bigger than that is.
And I think the other thing, I think perhaps we think about music as such a natural force that all this stuff just happens. Some of it does, but it sounds to me it's a huge amount of intentionality behind everything that's going on. And we're talking about this band and this group of people and everyone that's around it. It sounds to me everyone's has a huge, very clear intent for how they want to be and how they're going to pass that on. So, to your words, they can be in service of the audience, the fans.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And you never take the moment for granted. And this year's taught all of us that.
Yes, this year. And I did want to touch on this year briefly before we come to a close, because, you know, I know, my God, a tough year for everybody.
Yes.
But I just, you know, looking at the music industry, specifically the live music industry, obviously it's been decimated. Mm-hmm. No one can play. There has been no Glastonbury. Whether there will be next year, we don't know yet. Clubs are empty. How are you personally navigating all of this as a musician in this crazy year?
Like everybody, I feel like I've lived each week. I live the four seasons of the year. And I felt, though, that semi-stopped for me around July. And the reason it stopped for me around July is because I decided, Rich, in this age or in this time, especially this year, a lot of people become very conscious with regards to gratitude. And the thing that I feel where gratitude is concerned is I don't believe people are diving deep enough with the attitude of gratitude. And I'm going to condense that and make that make sense.
Okay.
We are thankful for things, but we don't follow the things to the root. So if I'm happy for my house, or I'm happy for my son, and I'm happy for, my car or my job, wicked, not a problem. But then if something happens to the thing, do you then lose the gratitude? Which then makes me go, because I was looking at it and I was thinking, so then do I want to be happy? Because if I'm happy, then happiness a lot of the time is based on what's happening. So then if the happening changes, do I lose my happy? But if I can somehow mind joy, then what joy will give me is the ability to be happy when my environment says to me that I should not be happy at all. You see, the reason why you love your son, why you love your son, and then he becomes the attitude of gratitude, is because you then remember the days and the moments where you weren't sure. And then all of a sudden, you now have the physical manifestation of what you believed in your heart and you thought you saw in your mind. What that teaches you is the very thing you're holding came by a process of journey that you had to go through the most uncertain moments to grab hold of the most precious thing you'd ever deal with. So it's almost like when my life was being reduced, Rich, it caused me to dig deeper. How deep were my roots? And sometimes I always see it like we're on gratitude branches, and branches are amazing, but they can break. You see Roots, the good thing about Roots is they're very rarely seen, but they're definitely felt. Why they felt? Because when the season changes, that's what allows your structure to stay upright. And so for me, I had a moment where we just got back from Saudi Arabia. Craig had been headlining a show with Lionel Richie, and we were looking forward to tour, and I'm sitting there thinking, yes, let's go. And then kaboosh. And then obviously you go through the first little phase, Rich, and then I was like, okay, there's something bigger than myself in this. And I started to examine myself, and I was just like, okay, what am I not seeing? What am I not doing? And it made me more mindful, and it was fantastic, because even with my college, I was able to teach, and I was able to do more than I probably would have been able to do had I been away the road. And as I kept moving forward, because what I couldn't do is I refused to allow myself to get into a place where I accepted this is life. No, because we know as long as we've been on this earth, Rich, every year has come with four seasons. So this is just a season. And when it doesn't make sense, it's at that point you need to find the strength to endure.
Yeah, by mining that joy, as you talk about, mine that joy, go to the depth. Where is this happiness coming? Where is the root of my gratitude, as you talk about?
Yeah, and peace.
Love that.
Peace instead of calm. Joy instead of happiness. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because you're going to the thing that's the foundation of the thing that you like. So my happiness can be temporary, my joy isn't.
Got it. Back to your point right at the beginning when we talked about sunshine and rain. You've got to have some of that rain. There's going to be a bit of unhappiness, but if you can keep going down, finding the joy. Oh, mate. Well, talking of joy, my friend, this has been a joyful experience for me. I've loved every second of this. So thank you. Thank you, Shaw Williams, for joining me. Now, I've got one final question for you before I let you go. Now, as I said, I think in the intro, I've been compiling a Mojo playlist on Spotify. All my guests have put one song in, which really gets their mojo going. And I only mentioned this to Sean just before we started speaking. So, Sean, what is the song you're going to add to the Mojo playlist?
I will be adding Earth, Wind and Fire's September.
Oh, yes!
Oh my gosh, Rich, I can hear it in my head. I'm about to lose my mind. It's
wicked. Well, that's going
so
in.
So please, everybody, enjoy that on the playlist and think of me and dance.
That is a gift. That's what we all need to do. Find the joy, dance more.
Yeah, man.
Well, sure, this has been an absolute delight. Thank you so much for spending the time.
No, thank you for having me. Thank you. And big love to all of the Mojo listeners. Guys, I just wish you nothing but love, health and peace. And have an amazing festive period as well to everyone.
Yeah, I loved that chat with Sean. Truth be told, I was at a bit of a low level of mojo just before we spoke. A few things coming together to distract me, frankly. But this chat put me back in a great place. The passion and energy, of course. The wisdom and philosophy which Sean shares too. Frankly, it was super refreshing. Just what I needed at that time. So thank you very much, Sean. And I hope all of you really enjoy it. Sean is one of many friends I just can't wait to see properly again in 2021, where we can actually get together. I'm really looking forward to hearing some of his new music and see him back on that stage at a festival soon. Wouldn't it be great when we can do all that? Okay, so remember to check out that Mojo playlist on Spotify. And isn't Sean's choice an absolute cracker? You can tell that from my reaction. And if you're looking to take your musical performance to the next level, Sean is your man. Give him a call. Say his details in the show notes. Now, in real time, it's the run-in to Christmas at the end of 2020, and there'll be one more episode in this series before we get to Christmas, and then I'll be back with a new series early in the new year with incredible guests lined up that I'm super, super excited to bring you. Please do help more people discover the Mojo podcast by sharing an episode, leaving a 5-star rating, and to really make my heart sing with joy, please leave that short review on Apple Podcasts. Okay, until next time, I hope your mojo continues to flow.